last time we had reached the point in the Megillah where Ahasuerus is sitting at the party, and he's been talking about how his wife is more beautiful than everyone else's. And Chazal tells that he wasn't exaggerating. Vashti was the most beautiful woman of the time. There was no woman who compared to her beauty. She was one of the beautiful women of the world. And when he asks her to come out wearing her crown alone, she refuses. And she says, "You're my father's stable boy. What are you talking to everyone as though the only reason you married me was for my beauty? I'm the princess here. And you want me to come out like that? No way." And when Ahasuerus hears this, he's very upset. Now, Ahasuerus was trying to strengthen his position politically by showing everyone, "I only married her for her beauty. Really, she's only queen because she's my wife." What's Ahasuerus been doing? Showing off his wealth. And when Vashti gives him this answer, so he has two problems. His first problem is that his wife just gave him such a disrespectful answer in front of everyone. His second problem is that technically she deserves the death penalty and he doesn't want her to die. He wants her. He doesn't want to lose her. So the law was in Paras and Madai that when the king had an issue with someone, the king would not rule on his own. The king had a court, and that court was called to convene, and that court had to rule what would be the ruling in this situation. Now, Ahasuerus calls the court, and he tells them, "I want you guys to think what to do with this queen Vashti." He stresses to them, "Remember, she comes from royal family, because I invited her and she didn't come." And Ahasuerus omits the fact that she cursed him out. He says, "You know, she didn't listen when I invited her, but she didn't answer me directly. I sent it through messengers, and she didn't listen to the messengers." So he's trying to plead her case on her behalf. She has to be judged, and he doesn't want her to die. Now, the servants, they're all sitting there, all these advisors, the officers, the sarim, who are supposed to rule on the case. And the smallest one, Memuchan, he's really small. And his wife is the big shot in the house. His other name is Haman. Memuchan is also Haman, we have on tradition. And he has issues of Shalom Bayis. And he has ego issues with his wife. So he figures, "Here's my chance. I can get a law to be put out that my wife will have to listen to me." So Memuchan, he answers first before everyone else. And Memuchan wants Vashti bumped off. Now, Memuchan tells Ahasuerus, "Look, you're telling us we have to judge this case. It's not true that this is a personal issue between you and Vashti. This is an issue of the whole kingdom. Because when Vashti answered you that way, she wasn't only answering you, she was really hurting all of us. Because what's going to happen when all the officers come home? They'll tell their wives, 'You know what happened at the party? The queen answered the king that way and she just got away with it.' And even those officers who are not here, but their wives are at the party with Vashti, they'll hear her answer and they'll come home and they'll tell their husbands, 'You know how Vashti answers her husband and she gets away with it?' And then the wives are going to tell their husbands, 'Well, if Vashti doesn't have to listen to the king, why do I have to listen to you?' So there's going to be a lot of problems here, and especially here in Persia and Mede, in the capital, where all the women were there in the party and they heard it. You can't cover it up. And once you can't cover it up, so when every husband has his wife talking back to him, they're going to think, 'Oh, it's all because of Ahasuerus. He didn't put Vashti in her place.' So you have to make a new law now that we're going to institute that Vashti doesn't come before you anymore. And we have to make a new law from now on. Even in issues that are just between you and someone else, you rule on it. You don't need your officers. Firstly, this is an issue that affects everyone, so you have to rule on it. And secondly, from now on, if there are issues that people offend you, you don't need your officers to rule on it. You should rule on it." And you know what? What's so special about Vashti that she's queen? You'll get another queen. Whoever marries you will be queen, and you'll find someone else that has yichus going back to royalty. You'll find someone else that comes from royal blood. Now, Haman also tells him, "You know what? There are other beautiful girls in town. You don't need her as queen. You'll find someone else who's more beautiful than her." And here we see the foolishness of Ahasuerus. Achashverosh is coming off of a conversation where he was saying, I married the most beautiful woman in the world. Come, I'll show you, she's the most beautiful, there's no one like her. And he really believed it. He wasn't just buttering her up. He believed it because he was about to show all his men. And here Haman is going to get away with something that's miraculous. He's going to say that all the king's sarim, his officers, should lose their power. That from now on, if there's an issue between the king and someone, the king should be allowed to rule on it. And if you think about it, there's a lot of wisdom to this law. That if the king has a personal issue with someone, that the officers have to rule on it, not the king himself. It limited the king's power, but it also ensured that there was justice done. It wasn't just an issue of the king has it in for someone, so he kills him. And here, Haman was suggesting that that should not be the case. And he was also suggesting to the king, we'll find you a better wife, you don't need her. And Achashverosh, when he hears this, he likes it, and the officers like it. And we discussed last time that we say that the Megillah has to be read from start to finish. And when you read the Megillah, the first two chapters seem a little bit superfluous. What we have to notice is the Esther, the hidden part of the Megillah, that even in this, when they changed the laws in Persia, when they accept Haman's suggestion, that is really the key to the final solution with Haman. Because imagine had the law remained as it was at the party with Vashti. Achashverosh is upset with Haman at the end of the Megillah. And Achashverosh says, you bum, I can't believe it, you tried to bump me off, you tried to bump my wife off. All he has is circumstantial evidence. My wife invited you to the party with her, why? I find you falling on her bed when I walk into the room, why? You tried to have Mordechai killed, why? Well, you know what, if that was brought before Achashverosh's officers, they might have been conned by Haman. Haman could have told them, what do you mean? Mordechai didn't bow to me. He went against the law. Of course I wanted to bump him off. What do you mean? I fell onto Esther's bed. I didn't mean to do anything wrong. I never had anything to do with Esther. Haman might not have been killed. And then there would have been the continued threat of Haman in the world. The fact that Haman now changes the laws, at the very beginning of the Megillah, he tells Achashverosh, from now on you shouldn't have to consult with us officers. If someone wrongs you, you rule on it right away. Well, that gives Achashverosh the power 13 years later at the end of the Megillah, or 10 years later at the end of the Megillah, when Haman actually gets Achashverosh angry, Achashverosh can rule on the spot, hang him, and he gets hung. And that's the solution of Haman. That's how we resolve at least the Haman aspect of the problem. So here we see in the very beginning of the Megillah, we start seeing the seeds of redemption that will grow, that will sprout at the end of the Megillah. And Hashem makes it that Achashverosh likes the idea, even though that wasn't what he wanted. He had called in these judges and tried to convince them not to kill her. And the officers also, against what we would expect, they say, yeah, it's a good idea. And Haman didn't overtly say we should kill Vashti, because that wasn't within his realm of power. Haman couldn't say we have to kill her. Haman could say, from now on she shouldn't come before the king. What he was indicating was that if she doesn't come before you, then you have no need for her. You have no need for her, then bump her off, which is what happens. It doesn't overtly say in the Megillah that Vashti was killed. It just says she can no longer be seen before the king. Achashverosh writes the decree, and here we see for the first time terminology that will appear throughout the Megillah, to his different states, Medina umdina kichtava, each state according to their writing, v'am v'am kilshono, and every nation according to their language. And in order to understand this terminology, we have to know a little bit of history. Before Achashverosh came to the scene, there was the king of Babylon. He overtook the throne of the king of Babylon, right? Achashverosh was king after Koresh, who was king after Darius, Daryavish, who took the throne from Belshazzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar. He took the Babylonian dynasty. He took the Babylonian throne. They overtook the throne. Now, Achashverosh came to the scene after Nebuchadnezzar, as we said, and Nebuchadnezzar came to the scene after Sancheriv. Sancheriv, he was a tremendous warrior, and he developed the following plan. He said, if I want to conquer the world, I have to ensure that after I conquer an area, they don't come back and rebel against me. So what did Sancheriv do? Whenever he'd conquer territory, He'd exile all the people in mass from that territory. He'd only leave the officers behind. He'd leave the governors, but he'd conquer, let's say he conquered Egypt, and he conquered Edom. So he took the people from Edom, he moved them out to Rome. He took the people from Egypt, he moved them to Edom. He took the people from Moab, he moved them to Egypt. That's what Chazal called Ba Sancheirev Ubilbel Es Olam. Sancheirev came and mixed up the whole world. Because Sancheirev took whole nations and moved them from area to area, put them under the governors who had been in that area. And that's why when Ahasuerus is sending the letters to all the different states, he sends the letter to the officers, to the governors, Midina Umdina Kichtava, according to the writing of that state. Because when he's sending the letter to Egypt, well, the governors in Egypt are still Egyptians. But the people that are living in Egypt now might be Moabites. So that's why Ahasuerus writes it Am Va'am to the nations, Kilshono, according to the language they speak. To each state that he sends the decree, he has to write it in two ways. One is the way the governors speak. They all spoke a foreign language. They spoke the language that was the original language of the place. And two is the language of the people. Now this concept is very important. Because when we speak about the fourth kingdom that we're under now, we say it's the kingdom of Rome. We say that the Jewish people are exiled under the Roman Empire. That's the fourth kingdom that we're under now. And people have asked, going back to the Ibn Ezra, why do we say it's Rome? How could we say that this fourth exile were under Edom? When Rome attacked us, Edom was subservient to the Jews. We say the fourth exile is Edom, and yet Edomite territory was in our rule when we were exiled. So how could we say the fourth Galut is Galut Edom? The Romans exiled us, not Edom. So the answer to that, according to one opinion, is that the people of Edom were exiled to Roman territory. In Rome, the people in Rome are really the people from Edom. When Sancheirev came and mixed up the whole world, ever since then we say the mitzvah of killing Amalek is not relevant. We don't know who Amalek is. Ever since Sancheirev came along, we don't know who Amalek is, so we don't have that mitzvah. We have it, but we can't apply it. The mitzvah of not marrying an Egyptian, that doesn't apply anymore. We don't have Egyptians. We don't know who the Egyptians are. Sancheirev mixed up the whole world. The mitzvah of not allowing people from Moab or Ammon to become gerim and marry into the Jewish people, that doesn't apply anymore. Sancheirev mixed up the whole world. So how come we say that Rome is Edom? That's because we have on tradition that Edom was exiled to the Roman territory. Now, let's pause for just a minute. We're continuing the Megillah, and this is what the Christians call the second chapter. And we have to remember that in almost all of Tanakh, the exception being the book of Tehillim, the delineation of chapters is a Christian monk did it. I mean, we didn't have these chapters. We had a different breakdown in our tradition. And it would seem that it's in error, those Baalei Kriya who end the chapters on a special note, that would seem to be an error, because this delineation isn't ours. And you have times where it's completely contradicting our tradition. Like in Bereishis, there are places where we had on tradition, this is not its own entity. There are places where the Medrash specifically says, you don't pause here because this is all one long story. And the Christians break it into different chapters because they try to give a different twist to the story of what's happening in Bereishis. And the same thing would seem in the Megillah. I heard this, I asked this question to Rav Kitzis, Rav Aharonov, and he started giving me this whole long thing about it. Really, it's a mistake. Over here, even though we're saying we're beginning the second chapter, we just have to remember it's just a way of delineating where we're holding. But really, in our tradition, this is no second chapter. This is a continuation. The parsha is a breakup. You'll notice that the Chafetz Chaim, whenever he quotes things, he'll say it's in this parsha, in Rishon, Sheni, Shlishi. He doesn't say chapters or psukim. The printers, they added in parentheses, chapter this, pasuk this. But Chafetz Chaim is very careful. When he quotes psukim, he quotes them based on the parashiyot. You'll see wherever the Chafetz Chaim, in the book of the Chafetz Chaim, Shmir Salash, wherever he quotes psukim, he's careful to say in the beginning of this parsha, the middle of this parsha, the end, the way the Rishonim always spoke about it. So now we're holding where what's sometimes called the second chapter. That's why Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and the old Rebbeim used to be careful. They wouldn't call it chapters, they called kapitlalach, which basically means a chapter, but like in an English book. So Ahasuerus's anger subsides, and he remembers Vashti and that which she had done and what was decreed upon her. Our sages say that this terminology indicates that there was a deeper understanding that dawned upon Ahasuerus. When he remembered what she had done, he remembered that things didn't go the way they should have gone. As we discussed last time, because he took out the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, Hashem sent the Satan to dance in the middle and cause a rift between Ahasuerus and Vashti. Here he was trying to show off how much he loved her and how beautiful she was, and he ends up killing her. That wasn't the plan. That wasn't how he wanted the story to end. So he realized, Et asher asata ve'et asher nigzar aleha, that what she had done in her wickedness, in her cruelty, she hated the Jewish people more than her father, more than her predecessors. She hated them so badly, she'd take Jewish girls and make them work on Shabbos, and she'd declothe them and make them work publicly, and she'd really try to get in at the core of the Jewish strength, the Jewish modesty. On Shabbos itself, she'd make the Jewish girls work. What?
Vashti.
He remembered that. Ve'et asher nigzar aleha. And he understood that it was a heavenly decree upon her, that things didn't take their natural course that night. And he understood that in heaven they had taken revenge of Vashti, and that's why she ended up dead. And when Ahasuerus remembered all this, at the end of the day, he still loved Vashti, and he missed her. Now, Memuchan had advised Ahasuerus, we'll find you someone else, someone who also has royal blood, someone who's better looking than Vashti. Now, Ahasuerus is taking counsel with the lads that are servicing him, and the lads tell him, let's make a pageant. They'll gather many girls, young virgins, and they'll gather them to the governors of each municipality, and then they'll choose the best girl, and each municipality will send their representative to the pageant, and that all these girls that are representatives will all be gathered to Heget, the head of your harem, and he'll give them their different jewelry and things to adorn themselves. The Gemara in Tanis says that when girls used to dance, there was a time when they, this is how they solved their shidduch crisis. Girls who couldn't find the shidduch, and guys who couldn't find the shidduch, there were 2 days a year when the girls would go dancing, and they'd have a special dance where the girls would dance in a circle, and then the guys would pick up their dates over there. If no one was setting you up, that was the place where you could meet a girl. So the girls who were beautiful, they would chant, they would say, young man, look what you choose, because a woman is taken for beauty. Those that came from a good family, they used to say, young man, you lift your eyes and you check out what family a girl comes from. And those that didn't look good, those that were bad looking, they used to say, marry for the sake of heaven. Choose a girl for l'shem shamayim, on condition that you give us jewelry. And the question is, if they're telling the guy, marry a girl l'shem shamayim, then wouldn't he rather choose someone who came from a good family? What are they telling him, choose l'shem shamayim? When a person chooses, and he's not choosing for the sake of anything, but for the sake of who the person is. She doesn't come from an exceptional family. She isn't exceptionally good looking. So then, if he really dates her and chooses to marry her, then he's really going to be marrying her l'shem shamayim. So then, the question is, why do they make this stipulation? But you have to give us good jewelry. Because even when you marry us l'shem shamayim, it's still important within the marriage that the girl is going to be beautiful. And a girl, even if she doesn't have the best looks, if she can dress right and put on nice jewelry, sometimes that can make all the difference. And a woman can, even the woman who's not good looking, when she's dressed well and she's adorned well, could end up looking very nice. So that's what they told them. Marry us for the sake of heaven. But on condition that after we're married, you'll still help us to be beautiful for you, because we do want to be your beautiful wife. And here we see depth as to... husbands sometimes miss this point. They think that the wife, if she's a tzadekes, or even if she's not a tzaddikas, she doesn't expect me to tell her she's beautiful. And that's a mistake. Every husband has to tell his wife she's beautiful. And not once, not twice, many times. Every woman wants to hear that from her husband. And every woman wants to feel that her husband thinks she's beautiful. When they gave Achashverosh this advice, and will give them all the different things to make them beautiful, what they were saying is, they were saying there are girls like those girls who say, marry us l'shem shemayim, but give us things to make us beautiful. Sometimes, if you have a pageant, so one girl is going to be better dressed than the other, she'll have better ornaments, she'll have a better hairdo. What we have to do is take all the chosen beautiful girls from all over the world, and then give them all the benefits of having the best perfumes and the best hairdos and the best styles and everything, and then you'll see who's the best looking. Because remember, we have on tradition that Achashverosh was married to one of the most beautiful women that ever lived, and for sure the most beautiful woman of his time. So he was having a very hard time finding someone to replace her. Vashti. And then you'll choose the girl that's best looking in your eyes, and she'll be instead of Vashti. Notice that the lads, they don't say what Memuchan said. They're disregarding the concept of royal blood. That doesn't matter. Once she'll be your wife, she'll be queen, that's enough. And now we start hearing about Mordechai. Now the Megillah tells us, Ish Yehudi. There was this man, the Jew. And throughout Megillah Esther, and throughout the book of Daniel, and in the end of the book of Kings, when the Jews are being exiled, we find that the Jews are referred to as Yehudim. The reason we are called Yehudim, simply understood, there are two reasons. Either because we are monotheists, and Yehudi, God's personal name, is the tetragrammaton Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, and Yehudi means I believe in the single God, I'm a monotheist. That's why technically, if you say that Arabs are monotheists, then they are really, with this understanding, they are Yehudim. They are not Yisraelim. They could never be a Yisraeli. Yisraeli means I'm a descendant of Yaakov Avinu, I'm a descendant of Israel, and I have that special blessing that God said, you'll be able to overcome the forces of nature. This concept that we say Israeli-Arab is a misnomer. You could say an Arab who's a Semite. You could say an Arab who's a Yehudi. A Jewish Arab. You can't say an Arab who's a Yisraeli, an Israeli-Arab. That's just a contradiction in terms. But okay, that's just a point aside. So the word Yehudi either means Kofel B'Avodah Zarah, one who's a monotheist, and that's why the Jews, when they were exiled, everyone identified them as the monotheists. That's what the word Yehudi means, he who believes in the single God. Or else, the word Yehudi is because the primary tribe that remained when the Jews were exiled was Yehuda. The 10 tribes were exiled, and either they all intermarried, or they were killed, or they were put on the other side of Sambat Yon River. We don't know exactly what happened to the 10 tribes. Most of them disappeared. Some of them came back. We still have among us people from all 12 tribes. We have a covenant. God made a covenant with Yaakov Avinu that all 12 tribes will last for eternity. So there are among us people from the other 10 tribes. But the primary populace was from Yehuda. And that's why the Jews were all identified as Yehudim. The second they were exiled, or the second the exile was imminent, the nation started referring to us as those from Judah. Because we know the land of Israel was divided into Galil, the north, and Yehuda. That's how we were divided. The 10 tribes were called Shomron, Galil, Ephraim, Yosef. They had all kinds of names. And the southern tribes, Yehuda, Binyamin, Shimon, Levim, and Kohanim, all those that lived around Jerusalem, those tribes were all called Yehuda. And being that the primary populace that was exiled was from the tribe of Yehuda, so we were referred to as Yehudim. That's the second understanding as to why we are called Yehudim. And this man, he was an Ish Yehudi. And those of you who are with us in our Pirkei Avos class, you know that the word Ish means the important man. Ish Yehudi, the simple understanding is, he was the leader of the Jews. He was the Jewish monarch at the time. He was the governor, the king, however you want to call him. He was the one who was the leader of the Jewish people at the time. And he was in Shushan, the capital, Hayyab Shushan Abira. He was ever present in the capital in Shushan, even before Achashverosh moved in. He was a resident. As we discussed in our first class, Achashverosh moved when he discovered that he couldn't move the throne to Babylon, so he moved the capital to the throne, he moved everything to Shushan. And in Shushan, even before Achashverosh was there, was this Ish Yehudi, Hayab Shushan Abira, Ushmo, his name was Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish, Ish Yemini. He was the head of the tribe of Binyamin. So the Gemara questions, wait a second, was he the head of the tribe of Benjamin or was he the head of all of the Jews? So the Gemara says he was Muchtar ben Imusin. He was both. When the Jews were still in Israel, before the first temple was destroyed 80 years earlier, Mordechai was in 85, 90 years earlier, Mordechai was in Israel and he was the head of the tribe of Benjamin. And then when the Jews were exiled, so there wasn't much left of Benjamin, then he became one of the important nobles of Yehuda. And when the king Jehoiachin was exiled before the destruction, 17, 18 years before the destruction of the temple, Jehoiachin was exiled, so Mordechai was taken together with all the aristocracy. Remember, they wanted to ensure that the Jews would not rebel again, so they exiled the leaders. They took the king and all the leaders, took them out to Babylon. They did us a big favor, because all of our leaders were out in Babylon, they set up yeshivas, and when the real exile came, we came to Babylon and found a place thriving with Torah. That was a big favor, the fact that they exiled all our leaders before they exiled the people. But the first exile was with Jehoiachin. And Mordechai, even though originally he was the leader of the tribe of Benjamin, he ended up being the leader of the among the leaders with Jehoiachin the king, and he was exiled. He was out in Babylon, and he loved Israel, so he went back to Israel. And then he was exiled the second time, and he loved Israel so much, he came back a third time, and he was exiled a third time. That's why the pasuk says he was exiled three times. Ayab Shushan Abira, and it says, Ushmo Mordechai ben Yehu ben Kish ish yemini. Asher Hogla, that he was exiled from Yerushalayim. Imagola Asher Hogleta, that's the second exile, with the exile that was exiled. Im Yechoniah Melech Yehuda, Asher Hegla. And also with the Golos of Yechoniah, the third exile. Three times he was kicked out of Israel. Every time he was kicked out, he came back. He loved Israel. He willingly came back, even though he saw the destruction might be imminent. He said, when I could be in Israel, I come back to Israel. And so each time he came back, was kicked out again. Three times he was exiled. And now he was the Ish Yehudi. He was the leader of the Jews. He had the power of Torah. He was on the high court. And he also had the power of tefillah, the power of prayer. God gave us different senses. And when it comes to learning Torah, so there are three senses we use primarily. Our sight, our capacity to hear, and our capacity to speak. We see the teacher, we see the things we learn, we see the text, we hear the teachings, and we speak in learning. Then we have a fourth sense, which is usually a sense that is used as an allusion to prayer, and that is our sense of smell. Mordechai is referred to as Mordechai. It's unclear if that was really his name. The Gemara says he might have been Pesachia, he might have been a few other people. Now, we're not sure who Mordechai was. But his nickname was Mordechai, and throughout the Megillah he's known as Mordechai. And the Gemara questions, why is he called Mordechai? And the Gemara says he was called Mordechai because that's a correspondence to the spice, Mor Deror, the spice of Mor, which is freedom. Mor Deror, the Mor Deror is translated as Meradachia. Meradachia is Mordechai. That's his name. That was his nickname. Spice is something you smell. Mordechai's essence was like the smell, his essence was prayer. Even though he was one of our great leaders in Torah, Mordechai succeeds in the Megillah through his prayer. And even the names that he's given, Ben Ya'il, the one who gave light, that's because he lit our eyes, our sight, with his prayer. Ben Shim'i, to hear, that's the second sense, or third if you're starting with Mordechai, that usually we use our sense of hearing for Torah, he used it for prayer, Hashem heard his prayer. Ben Kish, he banged on the doors. Kish is to bang on the doors of prayer, of before God in speech and prayer. So that's he used his speech also for prayer. He used those four strengths, those four senses in prayer. And that's why he's considered the one who led us in prayer and had the decree annulled. And he adopted his niece, Esther, whose real name was Hadassah. But right away when she was born, they saw that she was a modest and special person, a person who would be a tzaddiket, and she was given the nickname of Esther, the one that's hidden. He adopted her, firstly, because she was his niece. And there's a special mitzvah that one should marry his niece, especially a niece who no one's there to take her in. She lost her father when her mother was still pregnant. The morning after her mother became pregnant, her father died. And her mother died at childbirth. So there was no one there for her. Mordechai took her in. And he saw that she was exceptional. The Megillah describes her as Yifei Toar V'Yifei Mar'eh. And these, at first glance, these are two descriptions as to her beauty. And these are really descriptions which are used in the Song of Songs to describe beauty. And in essence, when we describe beauty, so on the simple level, we're describing physical beauty. And there is also the deeper level where we say that's a description of spiritual beauty. There are two types of beauty. There's beauty of figure, and then there's beauty of looks. The Jewish people in the Song of Songs, they say, Shechora ani, I am black, v'nava, yet beautiful. What are we saying? So Rashi says, we're saying, I'm black, only al tiruni shani shechachoret, don't look at me as though I'm black. Sheshezafatni ashamesh, I've become sunburned. That's the only reason I'm black. I'm burnt from my sins, but in my essence I am beautiful. If I will only do tshuva, I'll get out of the sun, you'll see how beautiful I really am. The fact that I look all black now, that's just because I've been in the sun all the time, taking care of other people's vineyards, looking at other religions, trying to adopt the ways of the other nations. Don't think this is who I really am. Really, deep down inside, I'm beautiful, you'll still see. That's how Rashi explains the pasuk. But there's another understanding, and that is, Shechorani, my countenance is black, vinava, but yet I'm beautiful because I have a beautiful figure. And if a person has a face that everything's symmetrical, the nose isn't too big, the eyes are in the right place, the eyebrows, everything is symmetrical, so that's another type of beauty, that's the beauty of figure. Esther is described as being Yifei Toar V'Yifei Mare. Both. She had both types of beauty. And these two types of beauty really are a correspondence to two types of spiritual beauties. When a person has their limbs are set in symmetry, what we would call a beautiful figure, that's a reference to the mitzvot. The fact that we were given a way of life, which is beautiful for us, it's symmetrical, it's exactly what's right. That's the best way to live on planet Earth. That's called beauty of figure. The fact that we have good traits, that a person is a kind person, the way you meet a person, the way he behaves towards you, the chesed of a person, that's good looks. That's Yifei Mare. Esther had both. And that's why Mordechai was happy to adopt her and ultimately marry her. She had both types of good looks, and we say they're both correspondence to her traits, to her spiritual attributes. And yet, when Esther is going to be brought before the king, the servants only describe her good looks. They don't describe her good figure. Because they didn't see the mitzvot, the tzadikas in Esther. They only saw her kindness. So when we say that Yifat Mar'eh, good looks, is really a reference to a person's kindness, well, when she's among the nations, they don't know she's keeping Shabbos, she's not keeping Shabbos, she's doing mitzvot or not. All they see is she's a kind person. So that's the description they pass up to the king. And when Achashverosh initially made the decree, Bishamad Dvar HaMelech, when he made the decree, I want all the beautiful women brought forward, she went into hiding. But then when it was heard, Dato, his decree that anyone that's caught hiding a girl will be executed, that's when Mordechai told her, you have to at least make yourself shown. Hopefully they won't take you, but they shouldn't kill us over this. And then they take her, and Vatilakach Esther. Esther was abducted. She didn't go willfully. They came, they knocked on the door, they said, we heard there's a good-looking girl here. Mordechai silent. They walk in, they look, they see Esther. They say, you come with us. She doesn't want to budge. They drag her. And now Mordechai is worried. What are they going to do with Esther? Is she going to get killed for what she did, the fact that she didn't volunteer herself forward or not? And so Mordechai is concerned that maybe Esther will be murdered. Maybe they're going to take her to task for the fact that she didn't volunteer herself. And so Mordechai tells Esther, his parting words are, don't tell anyone what family you're from. Don't tell anyone what nation you're from. Because what are they going to say about us? Those Jews, they don't love the king, they don't care for the king, they hide their good-looking girls from us. So Mordechai tells her, don't tell anyone. When Esther is taken to Haggai, to the harem, she's chosen as the most beautiful one of that locality, and then she's taken to the harem. So Esther, again, is not interested in anyone looking at her. But Haggai sees she's going to be queen. When Haggai sees her looks. When Haggai sees her kindness, Haggai says, she's the one. He liked her looks. He liked her character traits. He liked her kindness. Those are the two qualities that make for a queen. Those are the two qualities that make for a good wife. And that's why when we compliment a person's kala, what do we say? Kala na'a v'chasuda. She's good looking and she's kind. She has both. She's beautiful externally and internally. That's how we compliment the person's wife. That's how we compliment them. You chose well. Kala na'a v'chasuda. We don't go looking at her looks, but we sing for every chasm. You chose a good wife. She's na'a v'chasuda. What happens if she doesn't have such good looks? We say, yeah, but in his eyes she has good looks. We still say, Kala na'a v'chasuda. That's what we sing before every chasm. When Haggai catches on, she's going to be queen. So Haggai takes his course of action. He says, I gotta be careful with this woman. And so he's always quick to bring her stuff. He goes to the king's palace and he says, I know the queen is going to have 7 servants. I have the woman that's going to be queen. I want those 7 servants for that woman. And then he takes the best rooms in the harem and he puts Esther and her maidservants there. And Haggai had a good eye. He was right. We know he was right. Esther was chosen ultimately. Esther's in the harem and she sees they're not bringing her before a court and no one's talking about her past and she doesn't have to worry, she's going to be killed. Mordechai comes every day. He knows that Esther might be killed and he also knows that Esther hates where she is. And he is concerned for Esther's well-being. When a person is in a situation, be it a job or something else that they hate, day after day after day, we have to be concerned what that will do to affect the person's emotional well-being. And so Mordechai comes day after day, ladat et shlom Esther, to know Esther's peace. How's she doing with this situation? We say, yeah, she stood up to the challenge. Of course she stood up to the challenge. She had no choice. But Mordechai didn't know if she'd fall into depression. So Mordechai came day after day, ladat et shlom Esther, to know her peace. Umayya seba, will she be killed? Esther sees, they're not killing me. They're not even judging me. They're giving me the best treatment. I don't know, why did Uncle Mordechai tell me, don't tell them what family you're from or what nation you're from? Because he was concerned they might kill me and kill him and kill the family and kill everyone because I was in hiding. They're not killing me. Quite the contrary, they're giving me the best treatment. And yet, lo yigida Esther. Esther does not reveal et amavet moladeta. She doesn't reveal it. Ki Mordechai tziva aleha shelo tagid. Mordechai told her, she listens to her Uncle Mordechai. She thinks, you know, he's off, he's wrong. Really, I could tell her, but that's why the Megillah keeps telling us throughout the Megillah. Esther did it because she listened to her Uncle Mordechai. Her rabbi told her, don't tell. She says, okay, I think there's no danger in telling, but he told me not to tell. I listened to him. And at the end of the day, that's another of the keys that opened the door to redemption, as we will see later in the Megillah.